Well, good afternoon. This is a lot easier afternoons than yesterday's. I wanted to assure you all that I'm not in pain, that I wounded myself, but I did not hurt myself, which was very fortunate. It looked terrible in a fascinating way, if you are interested in such things. But it really didn't hurt at all, including the only thing that hurt at the hospital was the tetanus shot. And that was like that. So thank you for your patience and for your sympathy and all your help. And I'm allowing more help. I've been very stubborn and just wanting to do it all myself, which is not a good idea. And not only for myself, but for everybody. So I apologize for being so bullheaded. And Wendy and Heinrich are taking care of me today very well. And I'm being exceedingly careful. Sam, you weren't here yesterday, so you don't know about how strange that was, but it's over. So we have a new face today to some of you. You can introduce yourself. And two faces that I didn't introduce yesterday. I'm sorry, I overlooked you both in my kerfluffle. Tilda and Lara. It's very nice to have you joining our sit and sitting together with us. This is lovely. It's so encouraging when people come and go in this way. It's sad to say goodbye to people. Yoshiko left this morning, and I thought, oh, you know, there's a hole in the Sangha. And then, you know, Sam shows up and fills it up. So it's nice that way. We're going to, as you all know, have a couple of ordinations day after tomorrow. Maybe there's a little frisson when I said that for a couple of people. It's a very simple ceremony. In Zen, we really basically do one ceremony. It's the precept ceremony. We do it for weddings and funerals, baby blessings, house blessings, and all the various ordinations that we go through as we pass along in time with our practice. As I said the first day, the first one is the staying at home and practicing the way. And that's called Jukai, when you receive one of these that you've sewn yourself, if you're able. And your teacher writes something on the back of it, including your new name. This one I received from Vanya at the transmission ceremony that he did here the year that Koban died, or the year next year, I guess. So this has the three names of us. The two women who were transmitted with me, Jean and Carolyn, Carolyn Atkinson, and then Vanya, and the date. They're all different. Sometimes the teacher will draw a picture on it, or write a big word, or something that seems relevant to that one being who receives a rakusu. In the ordination for leaving home, which we talked about a bit, that it doesn't mean you're going to march out the door and house and slam the door. It's not about departing from your beloveds forever. But it's a big change of mind. It's taking the vows that we were talking about yesterday and living them wherever you are. And wherever you are is home. So there's not just one home anymore. Everywhere is home. And everywhere is a place to practice. So it's doing Jukai is a very important first step. You can do Jukai with one teacher and then do the ordination with another teacher. But doing the ordination with a teacher, the home-leaving one, is cementing a relationship. Cementing is really a very strange word for it, but that's what we say in English. But it's a recognition of a relationship that is irrevocable, whatever happens. I myself got in trouble with my teacher, and he turned his back on me every time I showed up somewhere when he was. And yet it had nothing to do with the irrevocable relationship that we had together. Eventually he turned back, mercifully. It was a very painful time, but it shows how serious the situation is when you take on this very deep practice in relationship. It's not just your thing that you do when you go to a sit on a Saturday or something. It's a life. And it doesn't mean a life in a monastery or maintaining a place like a place like this. It can, but it can mean doing anything. I met a pharmacist in Japan who is a monk and goes back for 3 month practice in the summer to his monastery. I met a priest who is also an airline pilot and puts his whole hearted practice into being an airline pilot. So it isn't that you're marrying Zen. It's not at all about marrying Zen. But it is a kind of wedding. But it's becoming part of Buddha's family. So the ceremony is consists of just a very few pieces. The first piece is just a four short lines acknowledging one's condition as a human being. It's called repentance, but it's not exactly like the repentance that we know in the Judeo-Christian tradition. It's more like offering oneself in all one's condition, all one's way. Here I am, such as I am. All my ancient wrong actions based on from mind, speech, and body. Now I'm forgetting it. All my ancient wrong actions based on beginningless greed, anger, and ignorance based on mind, speech, and body. I now fully avow. So it's another vow, an avowal. All my ancient, sometimes they say all my ancient twisted karma, but Koban changed that. He thought that was a little too extreme and poetic and not quite accurate. But we can all understand all my ancient wrong actions. And they go back all the way. It's not just what I did as a kid. It goes all the way back to Lucy in Africa. So, after we've done that, then we've sort of cleaned the slate and created a situation in which it's not pure in the way we like to think of purity as being all scrubbed and perfect. It's just honest and real. This is it. This is the way it is. So then one can take refuge in the Buddha and the Dharma and the Sangha. Taking refuge is it sounds like it's taking refuge in something out there. And of course, in the course of the building up of this, what we call Buddhism, there are many, many different definitions for Buddha and Dharma and Sangha. Buddha being the perfect teacher, Dharma being the perfect teaching, and Sangha being the perfect life, they say. But that's pretty abstract. If you're taking refuge in that, it's hard to know what that is. What Coben said about it is that it's very obvious, taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, that it's actually nothing but taking refuge in your own truth, although you don't know who you are. So you've got two sides there. You take refuge in your own truth, although you don't know who you are. You take refuge to yourself. You reflect your own existence into the world and reflect the world back to you as the world is exactly. So it's a right here, right now kind of thing. And when we sew the robes, and in this home leaving, we sew a large robe, big enough to wrap around the whole body. And with every stitch, we take refuge in Buddha, plunging into the ocean of Buddha. Namu kiye butsu. Namu kiye butsu. It's a very, very, very ancient practice. And there are many, many stitches. You hardly can believe it when you start it, that there are so many stitches. And yet it becomes taking refuge with every stitch. And so by the time you have come to the place of receiving what you have created this way, you're imbued with it. It's soaked up in your body and your mind. And you still don't know who you are. The shape of these, as some of you know, are chosen by Buddha when he met with his disciples every year at the top of a mountain outside of town, where you can look down into the fields of Bihar, the county of Bihar. And the fields have been divided up for centuries into these strips, sort of like this, and then strips and strips and strips. And so when they gathered up fabric to put together in a kind of quilt, he said, let's do it in the shape of those fields. So when we say field far beyond form and emptiness, it really is a kind of field, which means the ground also. That we wear the ground as protection, as well as an example of Buddha's robe itself. When we say the refuges, we say, this is Coben's way, return to Buddha, return to Dharma, return to Sangha. Return to Buddha. Return to Dharma. Return to Sangha. Which includes, of course, everything. The robe itself includes everything. It is so big, it includes all. There's the story of the man who was traveling in Thailand and hooked up with a monk in a beautiful saffron robe, and they were riding on a train, and every time the train stopped, people came crowding around the window and started bowing and praising the monk. And the guy with him said, "Boy, doesn't that get to you after a while? You must be really proud." And he said, No, they're bowing to the robe. They're bowing to the robe." So, receiving the robe does not mean that one becomes elevated in any way at all. In fact, it's the opposite. Koban always said it's a stepping down. And it's taking on a bigger life in a way. And it's not easy. So one of the ways of thinking about Buddha, of the many ways, is of sheer awareness. But usually a Buddha is presented as a guy, a very nice, beautiful man. In the beginning, he was represented with footprints and a wheel, the wheel of truth. But soon they began making images of a person. And that person was invariably a guy. And so, although there were women from the very beginning, including Buddha's stepmother, who raised him after his mother died at his birth, women have been given short change in this practice, off and on. There have been moments in history when they've been empowered and recognized, and many moments when they have been subverted completely and almost disappeared. There are several people now who are making a deep study of this, who have gone to China and to Japan and have been looking into it deeply and finding the names of these people who were teaching, who left teachings behind, who were powerful and famous people in their time. This is new for us. It's new for us that when the Dharma came to the United States with Japanese teachers, they started ordaining women. Although it was considered to be very surprising in Japan at first. And for us who were involved with that first bit, it was very surprising also. We weren't even sure what it was, what it meant. It was so new. And yet, as time goes on, we begin to realize how important it is. When Koban first was involved with putting this place together, he asked me to make it into a nunnery. He said, "We should just have a place for the women to practice, and we'll have nuns." And I was horrified. I thought, no, it's too late for that. We need to know how to be together, men and women. We need to know how to practice together. Maybe because I was raising three sons at that point and felt very strongly that they should know about women and that we should all know each other and take care of each other. So thinking about the Buddhas in terms of women, I look back at the earliest images that we have in the world, and they're women. If you go to Les Ysées in France, there's a little museum with row after row after row of Venuses. If you've ever seen those Venuses, mostly they're very primitive, hardly any head, just a little tiny head, and then great big breasts, a great big belly, and a great big slip, all ready to present into the world fecundity and fullness and life. There were hundreds of them that they're still finding. They found the oldest one just last month. I can't remember the number, but it's thousands and that 30,000 years old or something like that. And that's the first real image that we've received is a woman's image. In our own practice, we have what we call in the Greek way, which is Sophia, which is a woman's image of wisdom. We have it as Prajnaparamita. Prajna is wisdom. It's what we chant every day in the Heart Sutra. And Prajnaparamita is a kind of mythical, like Sophia, image of wisdom, deep wisdom. And then as they were researching these women in history, they noticed that Bodhidharma's teacher's name is Prajnatara. And somebody said, wait a minute, that sounds like a woman. Tara is probably, you all know, the sort of bodhisattva image of a young girl ready to plunge out and help everyone. And Prajnatara. And Bodhidharma himself had five disciples, and one of them was a woman. That's part of his story. So all through history, there were fine, fine teachers of both genders. So that in the end, it doesn't really matter who's a woman, who's a man. In fact, some women go to their teachers and say, but it's not fair. You know, we have these stories about the woman has to turn into a man in order to be a good enough teacher. And all of that, and it really feels really bad. And I'm a woman, and I'm strong. And he says, "What makes you think you're a woman? You know, just erase that idea." But in my view, that's not enough. We can't erase that view. We live with it every single day, and we cope with it every day, men and women both. How we're able to relate, how we can meet. And there are great difficulties and great wonders that come with it. And erasing any aspect of it would be a big mistake. We are nourished and empowered by our differences and our relationships. A woman in, I think, Minnesota, Jody Speer, as one of many people who are working on a lineage chart of women. The Soto Zen American folks are still arguing, are discussing, discussing which lineage chart for women we should have. There have been many suggestions. There's one of a river of names running like this in a very elegant way, as a sort of curvaceous feminine way. One is just like the men's, just like this, with all the names, and then the line going back to the circle at the top. what Jody did was to make a huge circle, an Enso, you could say, and put in every name she could find, it looks like, starting with Prajnatara and, Mahaprajapati. And before Mahaprajapati, I think Prajnaparamita is in there somewhere too. And Maureen Stewart is in there. And I don't think any living Western teacher is in there, but the more recent passed away ones are in that list. And there are many, many, many of them. And then there's a little circle in the middle with two lines coming out. And on that one line, the teacher puts her name, his name, and on the other is the new ordinee's name. So it means that you get two Kachimyakus nowadays. This is brand new, and Carolyn and Paula are going to be the first to receive it here. I don't know who else is using them, but I thought we should put those to work right away. So, and then I need to mention also the Sangha. You know, Buddha Dharma. Dharma is the teaching of every kind, including what the trees are telling us and what the rocks are telling us. And then the Sangha is what Koban called all beings. When we set up the bylaws for Jikoji, they asked for the membership, and we told Sacramento that all beings are members of that Sangha. And they accepted it. So that's what Jikoji is based on. That's the foundation of Jikoji, really, is the three treasures. In that sense, in that broad, wide sense. So one more thing. This is something Koban said one time that two more things, but this is what Koban said that astonished us when he said it. And nobody can trace it, but he was so certain about it that there must be a way to know more about this. He said, Bodhisattva Mahasattva is the one who walks down, comes down. Bodhisattva is the one who endlessly grows, endlessly learns. The notion of bodhisattva comes from Mahayana Buddhism about the time Christ was born. About 500 years after Buddha, his teaching became very dense, very professional. There was a separation of laymen, laywomen from monks and nuns. The Mahayana idea came from a lay women's group. They are the ones who called themselves Bodhisattva, and they built a stupa, not a temple or a monastery. They just built a symbol of Dharmakaya, the content of meditative realization itself. And my friend Grace Sharrison, who has done a lot of study on women in Buddhism and has written a very fine book, found this from Chogyam Trungpa. Invoking the mother lineage. We pay homage to the mother lineage. Your robe is soaked in water. Your hair is elegant and airy. Your perfume is exquisite. From a grain of barley dropped on the ground by seeming accident, great prosperity has sprung. Your milk feeds the nation. We like the crescent moon on your hair. We emulate your openness and bounty. You speak softly, but your command carries weight. please do not stop loving us. We bathe within a grove of bamboo. Please help us to become gentle and tough. Other questions? Brie?
What did you say about that poem at the end that you read to us? Who wrote that?
Chogyam Trungpa.
Oh, okay. A woman.
No, he's a man.
But he wrote that to...
what? To Prajnaparamita.
To Prajnaparamita.
Yes.
Oh. And Chogyam Trungpa, is he still alive?
No, he's long gone. Long gone. Yeah.
My other question is about women's participation. The monastery that I was studying at formerly, the teacher's teacher, his name was Dr. Domino, who recently left Canada because the women were being ordained because the doors were closed, and came over here because he didn't feel that was fair, so he came to Canada in that case, and started teaching there to both genders. And so I'm just curious about if Bodhidharma had a female disciple, like what that evolution actually looked like of women sort of being denied entry eventually.
Well, you see it happening not only in Buddhism, but every institution that exists. Mm-hmm. It's very hard for women to have a place among men. An equally respected place among men. There's some dynamic that comes from a very ancient understanding of the physical aspects of women and men, that men are the actors and women are the nurturers, and we're built that way. And it seems like we're still understanding in that ancient way, even though we've surpassed the limitations of that, that we're not limited by the nurturing side of us. In fact, we can contribute greatly to institutional life because of the feminine aspect. And men can contribute greatly to householder life because of the masculine problem-solving aspect of life. So I think we're just at the beginning of trying to figure out how to make that happen. And it's happening sort of in a lot of sanghas in America. And Europe also, there's some very fine teachers, women teachers in Europe, in Zen. Koban always said, I don't know what to do with my women teachers. And so he didn't do anything at a certain point. He would teach us, and then at a certain point he just wasn't there. And then he came back, and sort of in a hurry, and tried to finish us up. He told me to sew another robe, and so I did, and I was still sewing it when he died.
He left.
Oh, he moved away.
He moved away.
Yes.
Did he say? I don't know what he said. I don't know what to do with my women teachers.
He told that to the men. I heard that from the men afterward. He didn't tell us.
What did he mean?
He meant that he was raised in a culture in which women had a certain place, and women have a different place here. And so he did his best for us. He did wonderfully with us. He did ordain, but with a lot of tremulation. And he didn't finish the transmission of any of us.
And yet he wanted to create a memory for you.
Yes. Yeah. Well, if we'd done that, it would have been a whole different story. Oh, my. Have been something else.
Japan, has been ordaining since the 80s or 90s, haven't they?
Ordaining women?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no, they have nunneries. They have, I think, two nunneries left out of all of the many, many, many they used to have. There's one famous teacher who's written a beautiful little book, Something Seeds, Aoyama Roshi. Beautiful little book, and she's very strict and very poetic and soft and wonderful at the same time. And she still has a nunnery in Nagoya, and her little book describes what their life is like. And several people have gone to train there, including Grace. Grace spent some time there. But not so many. Not so many anymore. Aoyama Roshi actually insisted that women be given equal treatment to men in ordination, which they had not been given before. They'd been all sent back to the cellar again, the way it keeps happening. And she just marched into AAG and insisted, you know, this isn't right. This isn't Buddha's way. Just like Mahapajapati did to Buddha. She marched up there and said, knocked on the door and said, "Let us in." And it was hard. He said no 3 times. Not easy. It's not easy. Yeah.
An exhibit from Pakistan in about the year 1 or 200 Common Era came to Tibet House of Pakistani statues of Buddhism. And they do start with the chakras and the
feet.
And then they have full, when they finally get full form, probably not much larger than I am, some of them are rough, and it looks like they were made out of the earth. And the gaze, sometimes the gaze is like we're used to seeing in Buddha, but sometimes the gaze seems to come out of you, but the artists are just beginning to learn how to have earth or metal not be earth or metal, but reveal something.
Yes. Make it live.
In the rooms where they had them displayed, I don't know if they came out to California, you felt you were in the room with people with practice.
Yeah.
And they had been buried and dug up. I don't know when they were found recently, but they lost for a long time. And it was fascinating to see the devotion that had gone into, if we're going to make a human statue, let us take our time. Let us find out what we want the statue to express, not just any old thing.
Mm-hmm.
It was very humbling to be living with that. Some of them would be the story of the Buddha. There would be friezes, and there would be a Buddha in the palace with women lute players and dancers and singers all around him, just surrounded by them in the palace.
Yes. Yeah. And then he left all that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, sounds wonderful.
And it may have had something to do about why he would say no more than once.
Yes.
Because he didn't understand that he could want what he wanted.
And also, I would think, having been to India several times, that it wasn't really safe for women to be out on their own. It still isn't. So it may have been that he was concerned about their safety, and he built in a whole lot more precepts for them than the men, some of which had to do with their safety, and some of which had to do with their status, which was at the bottom of the heap, no matter what, which was part of the cultural thing. And it still exists in the Theravadan tradition in some places that, in fact, just up the hill, up in Ukiah, for lunch everybody lines up, and the oldest practiced monk is always at the head, and at the back are the women, even if they've been practicing longer than the oldest practiced monk. A friend of mine gets so angry when she thinks about that. She says, if the women were not women but black people, then we would have a big problem and take the law in their hands and do something about it. But because it's women, it's just the tradition. Karen?
I always had a very interesting conversation with a monk on the island of Putongshan, just east of Shanghai, monastery, beautiful there. And there was a big statue of Huani, of Avalokiteshvara, of Vajrapani. And to me, Huani in China always looked female. And I conveyed that opinion of mine to that monk, and I said, isn't it great you have this? It's just like Madonna or something like that. It's the statue of the Madonna.
Yes.
The palaces, and there's a woman here. And he said, no. Wrong.
Yeah.
It's neither male nor female.
Yeah.
And keep that in mind. And, well, I tried to argue with him after a while. But this is my Chan experience. So I still think it looks female to me, but then again, who am I to argue?
Well, it's a cultural thing. Yeah. Britt?
Well, on that point, I think at least in America, men are denied any femininity. You know, like girls can wear pants, boys cannot wear pink tutus.
It's true.
I think that there's something in that that's not quite.
It's true. Yeah.
It's too weird.
Yeah. It's very dualistic, you could say, which is how our minds work. We like things to be one way or the other. And the truth of things is never like that. And so when we start to bring up something that shows both sides, people get nervous and don't like it because it feels unsteady. We want to feel like everything is steady and dependable. And all these ideas of pointing out, actually, that there are there are two sides that are working together brings up a sense, actually, of emptiness. The truth of things, which is that nothing is fixed and will never be, and that we're living in this very tenuous position from which we hardly understand at all, and from which we will have to depart at some time, finally. And so a lot of our ideas that we hold on to so tightly, so much of our obsession comes from just trying to create something that seems more real and more nailed down. And I think this male-female thing is a part of that. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And all the permutations of that. Oh, yes. Yeah. So, and we're beginning to break through that a bit. And it's shocking and very uncomfortable for people. Really don't like it at all. And then there are those of us on the sort of on the edge, kind of pushing the edge a little bit and taking some flack sometimes. You know. Takes a brave woman to take on the monk.
So I guess we are very sorry for that.
You men? Well, the problem is you didn't do it. Well, men did.
She was more of that.
We apologize too. Yeah. I think we all do it together.
We do. We do. We all are a part of it. Yeah. Yeah. I saw a hand over here. Oh, Laura.
It occurs to me that women are more afraid of their power sometimes than men are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How do you address that?
Well, a lot of it has to do with how women are raised. They're raised to be embarrassed to be angry. They're embarrassed to take on responsibility, to take a position. It's different now. I'm old, so my experience was very, very restricted as far as men and women are concerned. And I have a 22-year-old granddaughter whose experience is so different from mine. It's just remarkable. And her sister, who's 10, is even more different. So I think it's changing all the time, of course. But it's still, I mean, it's still there. It's still there where a woman in a class will have a good idea and it won't be accepted, and then the next day the professor, man, will bring up that idea as his own. That kind of thing is still happening. So that expressing your power isn't enough. There has to be some opening for it as well. And most of it's unconscious. You know, it isn't that there's a malevolence going on. It's just that we're all so unconscious about the dynamics of this thing. And we're trying to understand it. Books are being written about it. This whole business of extroversion and introversion that we talked about the first day, that's all a part of it, too, that we're beginning to look into it and to see how our minds work when we're not actually noticing how our mind is working and beginning to cop to it and take responsibility for it and realize what a lot of our struggle has to do with our own unconsciousness, our lack of awareness. So this practice is incredible for that. It's really, really good. And it has a history, a recent history of abuse that's kind of instructive in how even in Zen practice things can go terribly awry if the precepts are not kept in mind. That there have been several priests who have terribly abused their students and in several cases are continuing to do so or trying to do so. It's a very painful situation. And it's been the bravery of the women to speak up and say, you know, this has happened to me. Not just once, but over and over, that's finally beginning to slowly turn things and open it up. But it takes so much courage. And we don't... When my mother was a little girl, she was told the story in Helena, Arkansas, where she grew up on the shores of the Mississippi River, of her mother's sister, who, when she was a girl, was upstairs sewing with a treadle sewing machine while her mama was downstairs serving tea to the ladies. And while she was sewing, this needle went right through her finger and nailed her to the sewing machine, and she couldn't get it out. And she sat there the whole afternoon waiting for the ladies to leave and did not cry out. And she was considered to be a hero for having done that. And this was told to me as not exactly a model, but kind of, you know, that this is what women do. They're strong and they're respectful, and they and little girls just take their place and do what's right, and they don't cry out, even if they're in trouble. So you can see things have changed quite a bit. But it runs through all of our relationships, I think, and all of our minds. Oh my goodness, how did we do that? Tomorrow will be our last talk, and I want to bring up the precepts as a follow-up to this conversation, because of all things that we have to help us, the precepts are the best guide, the very best guide for us. And they're very simple, generous, kind. So thank you. Thank you very much.